Good morning. Hawaii's Department of Education wants pay raises for its senior leadership team. We'll hear how the teachers' union is reacting. Meanwhile, Hawaii is in the bottom of the bullying list. We'll get details from Wallet Hub and see what news analyst Neil Conan makes of a campaign that seems to be testing a return to the Cold War. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkuhl. Preparations are already underway for a once-a-year party, unlike any other, as Hawaii's Greek community turns out for its annual festival. And the road trip is one you'll never forget, but no one ever regrets a trip to Hana. The community will relive its history at a weekend ho'olauleia.
It's Tuesday, August 16th. Stay here for the conversation, coming up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Looking at a pay raise for administrators of the Department of Education.
Top-level administrators. Yeah. And we're going to talk about that this morning. We've been told that the Board of Education will be meeting in a little over an hour and a half to consider a request from Superintendent Catherine Matayoshi to give 20 leadership members a 4.5% raise. Her reasoning is that it would be consistent with the adjustment given to educational officers as of July 1st and to recruit and retain quality senior leaders. The deputy superintendent, 6 assistant superintendents, and 15 complex area superintendents. The total amount involved would amount to a little more than $143,000. So how are teachers reacting to the ask? Corey Rosenley, HSTA president, is on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Her argument seems to be, you know, you got to pay good people and you got to pay them well. Isn't that also your argument?
I think that is our argument. I mean, the superintendent said that in order to recruit and retain high-quality individuals, you need to pay them well. No one's disagreeing with that. The biggest problem is that while the superintendent's making this argument for top management, they're not making the same argument for their teachers. I mean, when's the last time you heard them going out, yes, we don't have enough teachers, we need to pay our teachers better? And I think that the problem is that we have a real teacher crisis in Hawaii. We're going to start off this school year that they're going to be close to 1,000 classrooms that are not going to have quality teachers in there. And there's going to be 600 of those classrooms that there are no teachers available. There's not a science teacher, there's not a math teacher on the entire Oahu in some places to teach. And so we're using subs that don't have the background. That's the real issue that we need to solve.
So what do you make of the inconsistency between her attitude toward top staff and teachers?
I think the optics are horrible. At a time, try to imagine a company where they're struggling to, you know, put out a quality product because they can't find employees. At the same time, they're saying, well, instead of taking care of our workers and fixing this, what we need to do is pay our top management even more. I mean, I don't have a problem with paying the top management more. You want good people in those positions. You've got to take care of your workers first. In Hawaii, we've got to really solve this issue of making sure that each child has a quality teacher. You know, what I say is it's like this. It's like we have pretend schools right now. A lot of our children are going to classrooms, and they are not going to have a qualified person. And what this basically means is last year on the Leeward Coast at a high school, they couldn't find a Spanish teacher. So they put in a substitute that didn't know how to speak Spanish. And those kids went the entire year without ever having learned Spanish in that class. It was in Honolulu District. Kids were taking a calculus class, and they didn't have a calculus teacher. And so all these kids, even though they're in a classroom and we say they're going to school, they're getting a pretend education. We're not giving our children opportunity because they don't have the opportunity to actually learn these subject matters and to get an education. That's what we have to solve first.
So if your point is that a lot of these classrooms are, as you call them, pretend school or, you know, play school, kids aren't really getting what they're supposed to be getting in those classrooms. Surely you've made this argument to the BOE and the DOE. What has been their response to you when you've said to them, look, it should be the same thing?
Well, this is an argument that we want to make clearly to them. And I think it always comes back, of course, to money. It's the basic thing of this. And I think one of the difficulties in Hawaii is because we don't have neighboring districts. Sometimes we don't understand how much we poorly fund our schools. And the reality is we have one of the worst funded school districts in the entire United States. And we know this because, look, our teachers are the worst paid in the United States. The amount of money that we spend on our school buildings is last in the United States. And
these figures are coming from what?
So the numbers are very easily to see when it comes to the teachers being the lowest paid. There's multiple sources showing that when you adjust for cost of living, teachers in Hawaii are the lowest paid. And one of the things that we've done also is we looked at other districts in the United States which have similar cost of living as Hawaii. And again, they pay their teachers better than they do in Hawaii.
So where, for example?
Say, for example, New York City. A teacher there in a couple of years is making close to starting salary $60,000 and make a high salary of $120,000. In Hawaii, for example, a beginning teacher makes $44,000 a year. And very quickly, people realize they can't survive on that. There's a story that just came out last week that shows that teachers, when compared to peers with similar educations, are the worst paid. And people have choices. If someone has a degree in math or science and they have choices of what they want to do, they're going to choose other professions. And when Hawaii, we have said we do not value our children enough to invest in them and give them opportunity, this has led to this teacher crisis. And 10,000 kids are not going to have a teacher. And we have to ask ourselves as a society, you know,
Corey, we've got to go
invest in our kids.
We've got to go in just a second. And you know, that same line of thinking that you've just drawn out is the same one that we've heard over and over again. What do you think is going to make the difference if clearly not having a quality teacher in a classroom and having, you know, many classes be, as you call them, you know, pretend school, what will be, you know, that point that will tip it toward the outcome that you'd like to see?
I think the first thing, as a teacher say, is education. I think one of the things we need to make very clear is that it's getting worse. We actually have more teachers leaving the profession than ever before, and we also have less people going into the profession. We have more vacancies than we've ever had before. And I think that we need to educate the public that this is the crisis that is occurring and that, you know, we have to solve this as a society.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, Corey.
Thank you so much, Beth.
Corey Rosenlee is the president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association and a National Board Certified Social Studies teacher at Campbell High School. And now some news that may bring a little relief to a lot of parents and kids. In the Wallet Hub list ranking bullying, Hawaii is in the bottom 10. Jill Gonzalez is the Wallet Hub spokesperson, and she joins us now with the details. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for making time for us. So in looking at this, you know, the states where bullying is clearly an issue are states that don't necessarily have anti-bullying laws, but many of them do. How can it be that they can be so poorly regulated?
Yeah, so we looked at three different categories here. One was the anti-bullying laws that you mentioned. Another was bullying prevalence, which, of course, hopefully is decreased by these laws, but it's not always the case. And finally, we're seeing bullying impact and the environment around it, so everything from the percentage of high schoolers that feel sad, that are afraid to go to school, or that attempt suicide.
When we saw Hawaii come in near the bottom of that list, there were, you know, two reasons that came to mind, because there are anti-bullying laws here and also an awareness that's been building over years for that. What does that look like when you look at the entire United States? Were there any parts of the United States where you find bullying to be particularly prevalent as a region, or is this all smattered all over the place?
Unfortunately, yes. We did see a little bit of a trend toward the Bible Belt in southern states. Many of those states still do not have many districts that are enumerating LGB and LGBT protections to this day. We also have many that are not really fully recognizing cyberbullying or criminalizing cyberbullying as Hawaii is.
Hawaii and Alaska are also are often compared to each other for a lot of reasons, but distinctly different as they've come out in your survey.
Yes, very. So Alaska is actually near the top of this list in terms of states with the biggest bullying problems. Alaska was right at number 10. And many reasons for that is because it does not have really a tenth of the anti-bullying laws and prevention steps that Hawaii does have.
As we look at this to go forward with it, I mean, Hawaii being where it is, listed as number 38, and we should say that there were a few states that you could not include in this, just a handful of them, so only 46 are listed. But although we are at number 38, nothing to be complacent about.
That's correct. So some areas, Hawaii is certainly setting the standard. One of those is what we touched on earlier. I mean, 100% of school districts in Hawaii enumerates those LGB and LGBT protections. Only the District of Columbia, of course, not a state, but we did include it. Only the District of Columbia is up at that 100% mark. No other state comes close to it, save maybe New Jersey, Maryland, and even they are not yet at 80% of their districts. So that's somewhere where Hawaii is certainly setting the gold standard, but there are certainly some other areas where it could do a little bit better. One of them was including cyberbullying as not only an electronic harassment, which it does, and a school sanction, which it does, but a criminal sanction. In Hawaii right now, that is proposed legislation and is not yet in effect yet.
And we've had that conversation for quite a number of years, as long as we've been talking about some of the other legislation that has passed. What do you think will make the difference in making that criminal?
Well, unfortunately, you know, the prevalence of bullying in Hawaii has definitely decreased. So I think because it's decreased, people have stopped talking about really passing that bill. Right now, the bullying incidence rate is at around 18.5%. That was one of the lowest in the country. Cyberbullying is less than that at under 15%, again, one of the lowest in the country. So because that prevalence is shrinking in Hawaii, I don't know what that push is going to be that needs to make the criminal act of cyberbullying into an actual law.
Or even if some will say that it's at all necessary given the figures that you've just given us.
Exactly.
Jill Gonzalez, thank you very much for a quick conversation this morning.
Anytime.
Jill Gonzalez is the spokesperson for Wallet Hub, a personal finance website. She's been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Kiplinger. And if you want to have a look at the rankings of the states for bullying, we'll have that on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:17. Coming up, the sounds of the bouzouki are heard in the land, but first, your quiz.
You may have noticed that craft beer is surging in popularity throughout the country, including here in Hawaii. The islands are getting hoppier by the day, with many smaller breweries setting up shop across the state. Kauai, Oahu, Maui, and the Big Island all have at least one microbrewery, and some Hawaii beers can even be found on the mainland. This success reflects a brewing tradition that is, in fact, over 150 years old. Hawaii's first brewery opened in 1854 on Fort Street in Honolulu. And today we're looking for the name of the man who opened that brewery, the founding father of Hawaii's beer industry. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Chris Lee from Eurocinema Hawaii. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Some of the first Greeks came to Hawaii in the 1830s aboard whaling ships, and that was the origin of one of Hawaii's most closely knit immigrant communities, one whose members have stayed in close touch with one another ever since. For 35 years now, Hawaii's Greek families have put on a festival that has become an end-of-summer tradition. Regina Mass is one of its volunteer coordinators, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Regina.
Kalimera. Good morning.
What do you think keeps the Greek community as closely knit as it is?
Part of it is the church. We are bound by the church, and we keep in close contact because of that. Mm-hmm. We also enjoy Greek cooking. We enjoy our culture, love the music, and we tend to like to party, so we're always happy to be together.
A lot of those things are built into the culture as you've experienced it, yeah?
Yes, that's true.
What was it like for you growing up here?
Well, actually, I grew up on the mainland, and I did have the opportunity to live in Greece for 2 years after I graduated from high school. And I lived on a little Greek island that was 12 miles long and 6 miles wide. It's where I began to love living on islands. I think it's funny when I hear people on Oahu tell me that they have rock fever. I say to them, get in the car and drive somewhere.
Yeah, sure.
But it's been a wonderful experience. When I moved to Hawaii, I was so happy to find a Greek community that was in place and was as vibrant as it was. It made me feel at home.
What were the things that you associated with life on that island?
Primarily, when I lived there, the island only had electricity for 4 hours a night. So people really lived a very traditional lifestyle. I saw people weaving. I saw them making yarn. They raised virtually all of their crops, all the food for their homes. Every family made one or two kinds of wine. Many of them made beer, by the way, and that island was famous for its barley, which they sold as a cash crop to the beer makers in Athens.
Uh-huh.
Kind of interesting that you started off talking about beer today.
Yeah, yeah.
We are going to be having Greek beer at our Greek festival, and I'm sure that a lot of people will enjoy coming down and sampling that.
Well, the life on that island, what was the name of that island?
That was Kithnos. There were two villages, and they were a little more than an hour's walk apart. I would walk through an almond grove, a lemon grove. I would walk past 12 churches and one monastery, which no longer had any monks, but it was still a well-maintained monastery. I would stop and look at the beautiful icons in each one. But most people in my village had never been to the other village, and they would ask me what it was like. And they would say, well, what language do they speak? Well, what kind of food do they eat over there? What do they wear? And I found out through research, I was doing an anthropological study, that they were minimalizing interaction because for historic reasons. The other village at one point had been populated by Venetians. Venice owned those islands for 400 years, and they were Catholic. They spoke Italian, so they saw themselves as different people. But today, everyone is Greek Orthodox. Everyone speaks Greek, but they still think of themselves as two very distinct villages.
Which shows you how an idea like that can take hold and last for centuries after it's no longer accurate, right?
That's true.
That's amazing, which as an anthropologist has got to be a fascinating aspect of human nature, yeah?
Yes. I'm amazed at how vibrant the Greek culture is here in Hawaii, especially since there were so few Greeks.
Yeah.
About 2 months ago, we were contacted by a woman who is of Hawaiian Greek descent. She said that her family story is that her ancestor was a sailor on a whaler, and he came to Hawaii in 1830. And she has very little information about him and was hoping that the people of the church could provide some documentation for her. We're trying to help her research that. But many of us were sure that there were whalers and sailors that came to Hawaii early on. We know that the first Greek moved here in 1883, in the fall of 1883, and that was Peter Camarinos, who was from Sparta, and he opened the California Fruit Market on the corner of King and Alakea. And he encouraged other young men from his village in Sparta to come. He told them this was a land of opportunity. And between 1883 and 1900, there were approximately 50 young men living in Honolulu and Hilo of Greek descent. One was his very famous cousin, George Lycurgus, who later moved to the Big Island and operated the Volcano House. And he was probably one of the most colorful of all the Greeks that has ever lived in Hawaii. By 1941, there were about 200 men, women, and children of Greek descent, and today there are about 3,000. Many of them are maybe just a fraction Greek, but they strongly identify with that Greek portion of their heritage.
Yeah. In the days of men like Peter Camarinos and George Lycurgus, the Greek community was somewhat at odds with the missionary community and known to be friends and supporters of the monarchy even after the overthrow, right?
Yes, and one of the most famous stories is that George Lycurgus took up arms to help Queen Liliuokalani regain her throne and mm-hmm. was thrown into prison.
So they were sort of that tradition of democratic revolution.
Yes.
Seems to have stayed strong within that community as well, right?
I think so, yes.
What happened in World War II in the Greek community? What was the effect of that conflict on the local community?
You know, it was very interesting. Four of the main families lived side by side. They lived on Spencer Street close to Wilder Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was beneficial to the four to live there. They were cousins, they were friends, they were co-businessmen. The wives were able to help and support each other. The wives, when they came to Hawaii, did not speak English. At least two of them signed up for classes to learn English at the YMCA,
mm-hmm.
An English for Foreigners program. And so these four families lived together. The men would be working, and the women could help each other. They built an air raid shelter in the backyard, and the four families shared it, and they stocked it. They told me it was very well supplied. And several of them said it had a Nikon and it had a bottle of ouzo. And I guess that's what you need in times of fear. You need spiritual support and comfort, and you also need some physical comfort.
Sure.
Yeah.
What was that word you used? We were talking earlier. There's mm-hmm. a Greek word for the tradition of hospitality.
Philoxenia. It means love of the stranger or love of strangers, and it's so totally ingrained in our culture. I think this is one of the reasons why today we see the island of Lesbos taking in all these refugees. They can't turn them away because that is so ingrained in the culture.
That's a lovely notion to have built into your culture, isn't it?
It is. During the war, many of the Greek families would meet Greek American sailors and soldiers, and they would bring them home. Those sailors and soldiers attended many a party in the Greek-American community on Oahu, and
that tradition continues.
Yes, they would be brought home for Sunday dinner, and they were made to feel a part of the family. Of course, the fathers were all looking for Greek-American son-in-laws for their daughters.
Who could blame them, Regina?
Right.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Regina Mass is a volunteer coordinator for Hawaii's annual Greek Festival, which will be held at McCoy Pavilion in Ala Moana Park, August 27th and 28th, from noon till 9 p.m., sponsored by Saints Constantine and Helen, Greek Orthodox Cathedral of the Pacific. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hawaii Public Radio has the largest radio newsroom in Hawaii, and we produce programs that make up more than a quarter of what's on our air, and we provide two program streams. That's just part of the reasons why Cindy Seidel of Honolulu, Yvonne Duncan of Kula, and John McHugh give to their public radio station, and mahalo to all of our members who understand the pride of place every day. We hope you'll join them. You can call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go online and donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. They say the best defense is a good offense. In the federal investigation of HPD Chief Kea Aloha and his prosecutor wife, could lawsuits and going public to affect public perceptions also be too much dirty laundry? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Over such a long time now, we've heard so much about this case and its offshoots and the investigation. Is this a very risky business for the Kea Aloha to be so public about it?
Well, that's certainly the view of several legal experts. One even called it bizarre. Bethann, it's hard to remember that this started with a stolen mailbox, remember? And now there's a federal investigation into possible corruption at HPD. Of course, Louis Kea Aloha is the chief of that department. There's also been Ethics Commission investigations. And so the Kea Alohas, with their own legal counsel, have decided, you know what? We're being tried in public opinion. We are being vilified unfairly. So therefore, they had no choice but to take their case public. So they're suing people and they're giving interviews to try and persuade people to their side.
There's also this issue of whether there's some sort of, conspiracy to get them. Is there?
Our Nick Gruby actually spoke with Catherine Kea Aloha and said, this kind of sounds like a conspiracy, right? She said, yes, I agree. It does sound that way. But Kea Aloha, who, as you said, is a city prosecutor, she's saying, no, it's not a conspiracy. But she is saying there are multiple groups that are out to get them, she and her husband. She says, in part, it may be because she's been working on a case having to do with the high cost of living, and maybe she's made too many enemies in the city and county.
Well, that aside, though, there is still the issue with so much of this, swirling around them. Should, in fact, they be more removed from the public eye, or certainly from their own business concerns? And for HPD chief, that would mean stepping down.
That's something that Charles DeJoux, the candidate for mayor, has called for, saying, look, this does not look right. You should step aside until the investigation is completed. Kirk Caldwell, the mayor, by contrast, has taken a hands-off approach, saying it's really with the police commission to handle and let the investigation take its course.
He said that when we talked to him a few weeks ago. Meanwhile, though, voters are going to be asked come Election Day if they want to make it a little easier for the Honolulu Police Commission to exert a little bit more will over the police chief.
Yes, and that's something that certainly the Kea Aloha case is certainly going to provide some background, some information. At least one new member of the commission says, in fact, we should be asking questions, meaning the police commission, about what's going on with their chief.
So at this point, we're still in a holding pattern with this. No end in sight for this one.
No, you and I will be talking about this one again, Bethann.
Okay, that's a promise. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily with a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Bring back the Cold War? After yet another week of mistakes, Donald Trump proposes ideological tests for immigrants and visitors to the United States. Another set of emails reinforces doubts about Hillary Clinton, and Russia expands its role in the Middle East. Those are some of the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week. Neil joins us most Tuesdays from his MacNut farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So last week we were talking about Donald Trump's long-awaited pivot to a more serious campaign after a relatively well-received economic speech in Detroit. But just a few hours later, he was back on Twitter and back to some of his more outrageous remarks at unscripted rallies. At this point, it doesn't really look like he's going to change, does it?
No. In an interview with Time Magazine, he basically said, you know, I am who I am. And he talked about his advisors giving him advice to, you know, read more scripted speeches, but also about how he prefers the freewheeling approach that succeeded beyond all expectations in the Republican primary, and without realizing how badly that approach seems to be failing now, and that's why we're seeing reports of panic in the Republican Party.
New York Times came out with a story over the weekend on Sunday that portrays Trump as exhausted, sullen, erratic, also as someone who is bewildered, according to the report, by the very basics of politics. How can this be?
A really interesting story. I should point out the Times said he was obsessed by the media, a conclusion he promptly validated with a Twitter rant about the New York Times. And this was, of course, after he attacked the news media in general and after he yet again questioned the First Amendment to the Constitution. And that, of course, was just one of several fundamental mistakes over the past 7 days. And among them, and getting to your point about being bewildered about the basics of politics, was his insistence on a campaign stop in Connecticut, which was a complete waste of time. And you don't see Hillary Clinton stopping over in Oklahoma, but he has a deep-seated belief that places he thinks he knows, like Connecticut and New York and New Jersey, are somehow going to come around to vote for him in November, when he clearly needs to spend more time in, you know, places like Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Okay, well, he did campaign in Pennsylvania last week, and he also seemed to acknowledge that the polls show him down by as much as 10 points there. He also says that if he doesn't win Pennsylvania in November, well, the only reason is cheating. Now, today, the Washington Post poll has him trailing Clinton by 14 points in Virginia. Is he just making excuses for losing 3 months before Election Day?
3 months before. Yeah, it's what it sounds like. You know, I was robbed. They stole the election. You know, this is desperation. This is flailing, as if he can't see any reason he could possibly lose except that they're all out to get him. Mr. Trump has shown a weakness for conspiracy theories in the past. Remember, he was the heart and soul of the birther movement who demanded Barack Obama's birth certificate. And, of course, in that effort, he sought to undermine the legitimacy of the current president of the United States. And in this, you know, the election is rigged thread, he's undermining the legitimacy of the next president if Hillary Clinton should win, and the legitimacy of the most critical element of the Democratic system, which is the peaceful transfer of power, the moment when every losing candidate, this goes back to John Adams, says, well, I lost fair and square, and let's all support the new president.
Even Al Gore, who actually won the popular vote, we all remember, and lost the recount in Florida when the Supreme Court stopped it, even Al Gore conceded the election to George Bush at that very moment that you're talking about. Many wonder if Donald Trump would be able to make that kind of a phone call if he loses.
And he'd better start thinking about it. Hillary Clinton's lead is starting to look pretty solid, something in the 8-point area, ahead in all the swing states. You just mentioned Virginia, way ahead in the ground game. That's the organizational strength, the get-out-the-vote effort in campaign offices and volunteers and phone banks and data crunchers. This gets back to the panic in the Republican Party. They're beginning to think time is running out. Advanced voting starts in just 6 weeks, and it's not running out just for Trump, but for Republican Senate and even some House candidates. But, you know, for all of Donald Trump's attacks on the news media, there's going to be one story I'm almost certain we're going to see, and that's, hey, Donald Trump is coming back. 3 months is a long time, with the media having just a single narrative of a runaway Clinton victory.
But her emails, though, seem to be providing some really good ammo for that story on a regular basis.
You bet. Last week, emails, these were obtained legally for a change, show officials at the Clinton Foundation asking for favors at the State Department on behalf of big donors. There's no evidence, at least not yet, that those favors were granted, But this just reinforces the impression of corruption that big rollers can buy access to the Clintons. This goes back to, you know, Bill Clinton and the Lincoln bedroom. She and her campaign have yet to figure out how to handle not just these emails, but the decision to use that private server when she was Secretary of State. This issue is not going to go away. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks promised there's more to come from the trove of emails that were hacked out of the computers of the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah, hacked allegedly by Russia. And that sort of brings us to the international story that we wanted to focus on this week, Russia and the Middle East. Let's talk about that a bit.
Well, we started this week with the Cold War, so let's loop around. There are stories today that Russia just started to use a base in Iran to send strategic bombers on missions in Syria. That Cold War references. These are Tu-22M bombers. They were known as backfire bombers in NATO parlance. Now, 30 years ago, these were the subject of much controversy in terms of nuclear war. They have been used in Syria before, so that's not new. But they are too big for the runways in Russia's base in Latakia, to northwestern Syria. So they flew from Russia, and that meant that they had to fly with reduced bomb loads. Now, a base in Iran makes all those logistics easier. More to the point, though, it brings Iran and Russia into a much closer alliance in support of the Assad regime in Damascus, and it expands Russia's military and political footprint in the Middle East.
Not just Iran, though. Last week, Vladimir Putin welcomed the president of Turkey to Moscow. Now, just think back about 8 months ago. Russia and Turkey seemed to be on the verge of war.
Absolutely right. That was after Turkey shot down a Russian fighter that intruded into its airspace while it was on a mission in Syria. Since then, Erdogan has moved from an embrace of his NATO partners in that situation to a considerable degree of isolation. You know, after the coup attempt last month, there have been extensive purges, arrests of tens of thousands of people, the revival of Turkish nationalism. None of this has gone down well with his would-be partners in the West, so Erdogan and Putin are finding some common ground.
You mentioned that Turkey is a member of NATO. Is this something to worry about, or maybe something else to be worrying about?
In the short run, I think it is. They do have some common interests. It looks like they may restart their trade that was cut off after the fighter plane was shot down. But while Turkey and Russia have some interests in common, including, you know, sticking it to Berlin and Washington right now, they also have some really important differences. They're on opposite sides in Syria, for example, and as important as propping up Assad is to Putin, seeing him ousted is even more important to Erdogan. So this new warming, it may have limitations.
We talked about Russia's political advances, but things are not going so well militarily for them and their Syrian allies lately.
No, they provided a lot of energy to the Damascus government forces, the Assad forces, when they intervened in Russia last year. But things are, you know, the Syrian army was tired and worn out. A lot of its equipment was worn out. They got some new equipment from the Russians, but they're stalled. They did complete the siege of Aleppo, but then the rebel forces in Aleppo they broke the siege. They've reopened a supply route. Rebel forces in the northwest took back a village that they had lost. It could still get pretty sticky for the Russians and the Iranians and Hezbollah and the Syrian government. Those are now the big allies in this endless civil war in Syria.
And really, really super quickly, what about what's been going on in the past couple of weeks with tensions increasing again on the border with Ukraine? Is that going to get hot all over again?
It could. There's an election coming up in Russia next month. This could be seen as an advantage to heat that war up, to build up nationalist forces again to back the government. But probably just for a little while. This is all based on a so-called terrorist incident that Russia says happened. It may not have happened at all. So things are very murky there.
All right. We got to run. We'll see what this week brings, and we'll talk next week. Thanks, Neil.
You bet, Beth Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can always hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for the conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. It may be a surprise to some, but Germans played an important role in the growth of Honolulu. It was the Germans who founded the Symphony Society, which later became the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra. They began to arrive here on whaling ships. Soon it was clear that German sailors needed some local support. So in 1867, the German Benevolent Society was founded. It donated funds to help establish the Queen's Hospital. In exchange, members of the society received medical care. Decades later, the Queen's Medical Center returned this money, which was then used to create a scholarship for students majoring in international studies, and it set up endowments for other organizations, including the Royal Hawaiian Band. They funded the band and founded the orchestra? Of course, for Germans have a long musical history. You may have heard about this German fellow who was hard of hearing. They say he wrote a couple of nice symphonies. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the founder of Hawaii's first brewery. It was established on 4th Street in downtown Honolulu, opening its doors in 1854. We can infer from his journals that the owner had been experimenting with and selling small batches of beer since 1815. The first commercial batch in 1854 was made from barley and hops, containing no alcohol. An advertisement was taken out by the brewery's proprietor, reading, "We are now prepared to supply families, hotels, boarding houses, and bar rooms in bottles or kegs." That brewery was soon after branded the Honolulu Brewery and switched to producing alcoholic beer after its owner, Spaniard Don Francisco de Paulo Marin, sold his operation less than a year after going into business. That's the answer to today's quiz. Nobody knew it, so we'll keep our T-shirt until tomorrow. But if you've got a quiz for us, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
There's no place quite like Hana, and it's likely that its isolation, combined with the spirit of the community, will keep its unique qualities alive for a long time to come. Like all places that lie at the end of a long and winding road, it's developed its own character without undue influence from the outside world, and the things that make Hana special are being celebrated this weekend at the Hana Cultural Center and Museum's 18th Annual Ho'olauleia. Harolyn Kaivi is one of its organizers. She's on the phone with us from Maui. Good morning, Harolyn.
Good morning.
Have you been having fun putting this Ho'olauleia together?
Oh, a lot of fun. Always.
I would imagine. Have you been part of this in the past?
Yes, I have. Actually, this is my third year running the Hana Culture's special Ho'olauleia.
What are the things that make it, you know, distinctive to Hana to you?
Well, we kind of share it with the culture of what's happening in Hana and with the community. And we also, this is our third year of featuring A Taste of Hana, featuring all the Hana's best chefs.
Uh-huh.
And we have all local entertainers here from Hana itself. And also giving out some keiki activities so the parents, you know, could come and enjoy the local arts and crafts and music that we have going on from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
And there are quite a few links to the past at this event and at the cultural center, yeah?
A lot of links, a lot, so much. I wish we had more time to do it, to share it all. We'll have like an informational booth about the past and the nowadays, and also featuring our called Faces of Hana,
mm-hmm.
which is all of our kupunas that was born and raised here. And we are still carrying over that and adding the new generations into the Faces of Hana.
Sure.
And it started in 1972, the Faces of Hana,
mm-hmm.
which is a special project for us. It's like a genealogy thing going on.
Yeah, it's preserving something that that really needs to be preserved, don't you think?
Yes, exactly, because a lot of the now generations have not met their kupunas, and to come to our culture center to hear their faces and know a little story about why their kupunas are there and what, you know, their lives are all about is exciting to share with the kids.
Sure. What kind of stories do they tell about what their lives were all about?
Well, for instance, you know, a lot of our kupunas, they did a lot of arts and crafts. They, you know, they shared their lahala lei making or hat makings, which we also have that in our showcase. We have some that was involved with hokulea. We have a carved wooden face of one of our main hokulea people that was from here, from Hana.
Uh-huh.
And to show that and tell a story of how it started and what he preserved and to share with his grandson, you know, who was a part of the hokulea, is an exciting part.
And that's a pretty powerful story in itself. That whole
Yes, it is. So that's the kind of stories we try to share and have people to come back and look at more of it and to share more stories about their kupunas.
Yeah. Did you grow up in Hana?
Yes, I was born and raised here.
What was it like when you were for small kid time for you? What was that like?
Oh, for small kid time, it was exciting. We live in a very remote, small area, but there's a lot to do.
Yeah.
And a lot to do is sports, family gatherings, and just learning about the history of where you live in. And every day you're learning something. I don't care. You know, I lived here all my life, but there's still a lot more that I haven't learned, in which I am just through talking story to our kupunas, share their stories, which they haven't before.
Well, you know, Harold, when you keep your curiosity alive, there's always something new to learn, don't you think?
Always, always something to new, you know, to learn. There's always new things out there waiting for you to just grasp it and,
you know,
share it with the rest.
When you talk about growing up in an isolated community, one of the things that I think happens for kids in a community like that is you have to make your own fun.
Yes, definitely. Because if you don't know how to make your own fun, then this life is not for you. It tends to be boring. But it's not. There's so much to do, not enough time in the day to do it.
Well, I think a lot of that, Harolyn, is the attitude that you bring to it, right? If you have that attitude, you can make your own fun. Otherwise, you're not going to have any.
Yes, you need the right attitude. And right now, as I'm speaking to you from my house, I'm overlooking the lighthouse of our Hana Bay, which is a family beach area, and looking at one of the history of Kawiki Hill. And it's a beautiful sight to look at every day to know about the battles that happened there and why it happened and how they try to, you know, protect outsiders from coming into our Bay Area.
Well, Harolyn, you're making a lot of people envious at the thought of the view you're looking at right now. But thanks very much for talking with us, and have a great festival.
You too. Thank you.
You bet. Harolyn Kaivi is one of the organizers of the Hana Cultural Center and Museum's Ho'olaulea this Saturday at the Hana Ranch Store Fairgrounds. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Beth Ann, we had a couple of lovely pictures of growing up in a simple island setting. One is growing up on Hana, small kid time, and the other, Regina's picture of life on a Greek island, both of them being places where you have to sort of look to yourself for your resources. You can't plug anything in. You have to sort of find out a way to enjoy yourself, and it's a good place to be.
And we see that showing up in the many focuses on different cultures that we enjoy and festivals that give that picture to people who have just come to Hawaii or people who have been living here for a very long time. So it's having the cultures that we've had here, it's a very different picture when you really start to peel back some of those layers. I mean, there may be 3,000 Greek people here, but boy, they make themselves known.
Each one with a story.
That's true. And we heard some of those this morning. And we'll hear more stories come tomorrow, specifically as we focus on the environment. Now, the Hawaii Environmental Funders Group is debuting its first State of the Environment report. We'll talk with Amy Hennessy. And we'll also find out about the Alawai Trash Wheel from Sustainable Coastlines.
And we'll look at a drug-free approach to getting past addiction.
We'd like to hear from you. And if you'd like to make your voice part of our program, you can do that by calling us at 808-792-8217 and leaving us your comments, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.